Right now, New Mexico U.S. Senators Tom Udall and Martin Heirich are hosting a town hall meeting at the Las Cruces Convention Center. This event is open to the public, and the questions will begin following a brief opening ceremony, which we now join already in progress.
Banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Thank you, Jesus, and our Las Cruces High Junior ROTC. Audience, please maintain your silence while the color guard departs.
You're listening to special coverage of Senator Tom Udall and Senator Martin Heirich's live town hall meeting taking place at the Las Cruces Convention Center before a live audience. Across the country, congressional representatives are hearing from their constituents about a wide variety of issues. Senator Tom Udall and Senator Martin Heirich are holding this joint town hall meeting in Las Cruces.
I'm Fred Martino, Director of Content for KRWG Public Media. For those in the audience who need translation services, we want to let you know that there is a table right at the entrance. If you do need that, we are providing that this evening. KRWG Radio is live streaming and airing tonight's town hall. We're also being carried by our sister public radio stations, KUNM and KANW in Albuquerque and KENW in Portales. It's the power of public media to provide statewide in-depth coverage of events, and we thank our members as well for making that possible. Senator Udall and Senator Heirich are live streaming this town hall on their Facebook pages as well, facebook.com/SenatorTomUdall and facebook.com/MartinHeirich. Let me explain our format and the ground rules for the program this evening. We have three microphones for your questions. You'll see mics 1, 2, and 3. You can line up to give questions behind those mics after opening statements, and we don't want more than 5 people in each line at any one time. Again, after opening statements from the senators, you can get in line, and we'll get to as many questions as we can by 8 o'clock. There are a lot of folks here, and we have that firm broadcast time at 8 o'clock to end the event, so we want to have as many of you as possible ask questions. To do that, we have a 1-minute time limit for questions, and we make this easy for you if you're asking a question. We have timekeepers here and here, and at 30 seconds, you'll see a yellow card, and then at 1 minute, you'll see a red card when you'll need to end your question. I will enforce the limit. Please be respectful of everyone, as we have a lot of people here tonight, hundreds of people, and I'm sure more questions than we have time for. If you don't want to give a question at a mic, no worries. You'll be able to raise a card, and one of our great volunteers will take that card from you. They will have a blue badge, and they'll take that card. We're also going to take questions from social media. So I know some of you have phones with you if you'd like to do that. Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, use the hashtag AskTomAndMartin, no spaces. That's AskTomAndMartin, no spaces. And I'm going to rotate this evening throughout. So we're going to have each microphone, we're going to have a social media question, and then we'll have a question on paper for those of you who want to put a question on paper. Speaking of social media, you may record this event if you wish. However, please do so while seated. And for that matter, we ask you to remain seated unless you leave to use the restroom. No raising of signs either for the entire event. Please be respectful of others throughout, and also be respectful of the senator's answers. We're all neighbors, and I know that this statewide broadcast will show New Mexico and the entire nation that civil dialogue is possible even when we strongly disagree about issues. If you haven't already, I will ask you to silence your cell phone, And I'd like to now introduce our senior senator, Tom Udall. Senator Udall is a member of the Appropriations, Commerce, Foreign Relations, and Rules and Administration Committees. He's also the vice chairman of the Indian Affairs Committee. And Senator Martin Heinrich. Senator Heinrich sits on the Energy and Natural Resources, Armed Services, and Intelligence Committees. And he is the ranking member of the Joint Economic Committee. Each senator will have some brief opening remarks, then we'll get to your questions, at which point you can line up at the mic. Senator Udall.
Thank you, Fred. Fred, thank you very much. Let's give him a round of applause. Fred, and this young man here with the great voice. I mean, if I had a voice like that, you should get involved in some other way. Anyway, I'm not going to do a long opening statement. I think Martin's kind of in the same situation. But first of all, just let me say, you have a really wonderful Las Cruces in the audience by the name of J. Paul Taylor. He's right over here. J. Paul, stand up for everybody. He said, you're real. I just wanted to mention, and I have so many friends in the audience, but I just wanted to mention him because he is really an example for me of what a public servant should be. He always, when he served you, I remember watching him when I going all the way back as state attorney general. My wife Jill worked with him. And he just felt, after you get elected, you represent everybody. You may have a philosophy where you come from and the values that you have and what you care about, but you feel like you elect everyone. And the important thing is to take that attitude with you to your office and work as hard as you can. I am very worried about where we are as a country now. I could even see us in a period of months here, headed into some kind of constitutional crisis with this new administration. And so I'm confronting this as deliberative as I can. There are so many issues that you're going to ask about, but a couple that I hope you'll ask me about is Russia and Syria, because I think we have some very serious issues going on there. I think in this community and being close to the border, immigration is a very, very big issue. I met this morning with some groups that represent immigrants, human rights, and various parts of the immigrant community, and specifically immigrants. And they told me about the kinds of situations they feel. And that's one that I think we should cover. And then you have an incredible federal presence here in Las Cruces, New Mexico, that Martin and I both work with all the time, whether it's the NASA facility doing its work, you're situated between Fort Bliss and White Sands Missile Range. There are public lands that we both worked in terms of designating national monuments. You have a great tourism sector in terms of people coming here, and there are many other things in that particular area. But that is to me, the first order of business is making sure that our federal presence here stays strong and viable, and that many of our young people are able to get work in that sector. And obviously, the national laboratories have a big job base there. So with that, I can't tell you, I'm going to do this by way of give Martin a second introduction. I can't tell you a better, if that's okay, Fred. It wasn't in his script, but anyway, I can't tell you a better partner in Washington than Martin Heinrich. I've known him for a very long time. We've ridden horseback. I haven't been on a hunt with him yet, but we love the public lands, and I think we met way back in the Sabinoso Wilderness, and he is every day. You know, you'll see a lot of our press releases are together. That's because we work together on things, and I can't have a better partner. And the other members of our delegation, we also work with. We appeared out in today out in the port of entry at Columbus with Steve Pierce, on the opening of the port of entry, an $85 million opening of a port of entry that we both worked on very hard. So thank you for being here. Thank you for being engaged. We will try to be very direct and to the point in terms of your questions. And Martin, I turn it over to you.
Thank you, Tom. Big round of applause for Senator Udall. I am really lucky to have somebody that I consider a friend and a mentor that I get to work with every day in Washington, D.C. It's no secret that New Mexico has a small delegation. There are only five of us, two senators and three representatives. So we work extra hard to work together to punch above our weight. And I can tell you the respect that Tom Udall commands in the Senate caucuses is really incredible. And it benefits what we're able to accomplish for the state all of the time. I noticed a few tribute hats in the audience. I want to say a special thank you to our veterans. If you would please just give them a quick round of applause. And I want to say thank you to all the student volunteers who are helping make this happen tonight as well. What Tom brought up, we have very serious challenges in front of us as a nation today. And ideologically and politically, we are probably more polarized as a nation than we have been for a very long time. And so what we're doing here tonight is all the more important. And I just want to say thank you to all of you who came here tonight, because democracy is not something that happens when you stay home. It's something that happens when you participate. It's a contact sport. And it's incredibly important for us to rise to the challenge of the times that we are in today, to hear from you about what you care about, what you think our priorities should be, how we can help the state so that we can take that back to Washington and act on those priorities. We're not going to agree about everything. Democracy is not about agreeing all the time. But the fact that you are owning this democracy, that you're participating in it, that really matters. And I am looking forward to hearing from all of you tonight. I'm looking forward to answering your questions. But when you leave here tonight, I would urge you, keep this going. Not just for those of us at the federal level, but be just as engaged with your school board members and your city councilors and your county commissioners. Some of them are in the audience here tonight. I see them. More than ever, we need to hear from all of you, and we're looking forward to doing that here tonight. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, and now it's time for your questions. You can line up five at each microphone, one on the left here, one in the center, and one on the right. We will be going first to the questions on the microphones, and then we'll be going to social media questions and questions on cards all throughout the night. Before you ask your question, we'll ask that you say your name and where you're from. And we're going to begin right here.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm Daniel Gutierrez. I'm from Espanola, New Mexico. I'm here for school. My question is about immigration. I have a lot of people that I know that have come into this country illegally, and that's their only crime. They have family, children, and they fear every day that this administration will send them back and destroy the family. What are your thoughts on that? And is there any way that, or anything, any chance about immigration reform?
Okay, Senator Udall, we'll begin with you.
Thank you very much for that question. And I first of all, think this is one of the very big issues that's facing our country right now. And this morning when I met with a number of immigrants and various organizations that were representing them, it really came through to me in a powerful way, the fear in the community. And these are things that, it's not just fear, it's sweeping into actions that take place on the ground. For example, children are not going to school because the parents are worried that they're going to be separated from their children. There are people not going to keep their medical appointments because of those same kinds of situations. And so Martin and I have worked very hard with this new administration to contact them and find out exactly what the policies are and whether those policies, whether they're going to continue Obama policies that were very well thought out with regard to a number of issues, whether it's DACA or whether it's people that are here and that have been here a long time and that have committed no crimes and are very much part of the fabric of society. And we need your help. If you have any issues in terms of contact with them, we can discuss those, and if they're individual issues, some of my staff members are here now to be able to deal with that kind of situation. But first of all, I think that we need to recognize and look back a little bit in your history as to where you really came from. I mean, I love my family history, so I go back. I know my great-great-grandfather came over from England in the 1840s on a boat and landed at New Orleans and came up and came out west. If each of us look back and think about that history that we have, we realize that, you know, this is the way the country was built. And so we got to remember the fabric of our society is an immigrant fabric. And these are the hardworking people that I'll tell you, the business people, this may surprise you, but I've had so many business people in New Mexico come and tell me, whether it's in the agricultural sector, whether it's in the construction sector, whether it's in the hospitality sector, that I would go out of business without the immigrants that work for me. And so we know how much a part they are of our society. And so what should we do? We passed a comprehensive immigration bill through the Congress, and that's the Senate were the adults at the table. It had issues in terms of border security. It created a path of citizenship for people that were here, earned citizenship with a number of criteria for people that were here that hadn't broken the law. And it also dealt with the issue of employers, because the main reason everybody's coming here is because they are looking for employment in a better life and a better living. And we dealt with all those situations. We produced a bill. We passed it. It was bipartisan, a big bipartisan margin, and the House of Representatives wouldn't even take up our bill. And so that was a failure of the House and a failure of the Congress and a failure of the whole system, and unfortunate for all of you that are here. But we worked very hard. I think we could take the same bill in its current condition and work on it and move down the road. So that's what we're trying to do now. We're in a tough situation because this was passed in a Democratic Senate. There's, as you know, executive branch and both houses of Congress are now Republicans. So I hope they'll work with us on that. That doesn't seem to be on this administration's agenda. They have a different approach to it, and so we'll have to deal with the legislation as it comes up. So with that, thank you. Sorry I went on so long there, but it's an issue I feel pretty strongly about. And I think, Martin, if you want to, we're going to allow him to jump in, and both of us will, I'm sure, kind of fill
it's
in the gaps.
Daniel, yes. Is that right?
Daniel. Yes.
Thank you for the question. This is something I've thought a lot about, in part because of my family history. My father came here as an immigrant in the 1930s from Germany. When I've looked at how people fleeing political situations in other countries have been treated in recent years, as well as how communities of mixed immigration status have been treated in recent months, it concerns me a great deal. And one of the unintended consequences that I believe is happening right here today that is unacceptable is that there is literally years and years of trust that have been built up between local communities and law enforcement all over New Mexico. And I saw this firsthand when I was a city councilor in Albuquerque, because I represented a neighborhood that was very much a gateway community. And we had to work very hard to get people to call the police to say, hey, I'm being abused by my boyfriend. You know, will you come out here and deal with this service call and not be afraid that that was going to become an immigration enforcement service call? We had to work very hard to get people to trust just to call up the police and say, we've got somebody who's got a meth lab in our neighborhood, but we trust you enough to focus on them. And we've lost all that trust. And that ripples through the community in terms of sexual assault that goes unreported, in terms of spousal abuse, and things that are very much not consistent with our values. And it happens because we don't prioritize things correctly. Under the previous administration, we worked very hard to focus immigration enforcement actions on violent criminals and people involved in trafficking arms and other things, illicit goods back and forth across the border. We don't have that focus today, and a lot of the recent immigration enforcement actions have been against people whose only crime is their immigration status. I don't think that's the right priority. I think most people in the Congress today, even a large number of Republicans who supported the immigration reform bill, know that we have a broken system and that we have to do something about it. We need to get some of the really vitriolic rhetoric to the side again and go back to work to fix the underlying system and to make the right priorities.
Thank you.
Okay, we have another question
Fred,
here.
Fred, could I just, yes. for one moment, I read your Las Cruces Sun News today. On the front page, there's a gentleman by the name of Roberto Gomez Jr. This is Roberto, a picture of his family 40 years ago. He came to the United States as an immigrant, and he's now holding, as a lieutenant colonel, one of the top systems and engineering jobs out at White Sands Missile Range. And so it's a part of the narrative that when I meet with your editorial board here, I'm going to tell them, I think these are the stories that need to be told to everybody because we need to understand the fabric of the community we live in. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator, I'll try not to do that again. And we have another question in the center with your name and where you're from.
Hello. I apologize for reading my question, but it will be far more expeditious if I do that. Hi, Senator Heinrich. My name is Nicole Bagg. I was the New Mexico 2016 Democratic Platform Committee member in Florida and in Pennsylvania. I am a former Democrat, current independent. In January, Senator Sanders introduced an amendment that would make it possible for Americans to have access to prescription medications at a drastically reduced cost by importing and/or re-importing drugs from Canada. I'd like to take a moment to thank Senator Udall for having voted for this amendment. I appreciate that. I feel that was the right thing to do for New Mexicans. Thank you. You, Senator Heinrich, along with 12 other Democratic senators, were responsible for the defeat of this amendment, 52-46. Your office representative stated that you voted against this life-saving amendment due to lack of FDA regulations and safety concerns. As I'm sure you are aware, 5 out of the top 10 pharmaceutical manufacturers are based within the United States. The 5 remaining European pharma manufacturers' medications must also be approved by the FDA in order for a doctor to prescribe that medication in the United States. My question is twofold. Please explain how an identical product that is manufactured under FDA regulations becomes unsafe when it is made affordable, and what are your plans for alternative legislation to lower the cost of prescription drugs for New Mexicans and our fellow Americans?
Nicole, I want to start by thanking you for the question because it's incredibly important to a state like New Mexico, where we are struggling under the burden of incredibly expensive prescription drugs right now. For my entire tenure in Washington, D.C., I have supported efforts to lower prescription drug prices, including the effort to allow Medicare Part D to negotiate for lower prescription drug prices. One of the reasons why Canada has lower prescription drug prices is because they can negotiate for lower prices. It is literally barred in law right now for us to be able to do that. My dad gets most of his prescription drugs through the VA. The VA is allowed to negotiate and they get lower prices as a result. That is the single biggest thing we can do to bring down the cost of prescription drugs. The night we had that vote, I spoke to Bernie Sanders on the floor and I said, I have no concerns about most of the drugs coming in from Canada. What I do have concerns about is when a manufacturer in Eastern Europe sets up a shop in Canada, imports into Canada, relabels, and this has happened, and then imports via mail order into the United States. I said, let's work together. We shouldn't have to choose between safety and lower prescription drug prices. It took, I don't know, maybe a month. A whole group of senators worked on the legislation. And about a month ago, we introduced legislation that sets the same FDA standards for all prescription drugs across the board and allows importation from any country, not just Canada, but any country who can meet those safety standards.
Okay. Thank you very much. We are going to go to our next question here on this side of the room. And again, if you can start with your name and where you're from.
Zach Socker. I'm from Las Cruces. And I am a lifelong atheist and humanist. My question concerns the Johnson Act, Johnson Amendment, which prohibits not-for-profits and religious organizations from being political action organizations. That act has been on the books for 60 years. The Trump administration is currently backing the Religious Freedom Law, which essentially will repeal the Johnson Act, the Johnson Amendment. I'd like to know what your position is on that.
Senator Udall.
Thank you. I think sometimes these, and I really appreciate your question, and thank you for your service. You're a Air Force veteran, right? I think the idea of the Johnson Amendment and this whole issue is being very confused by the debate that's going on. I think it was really clear to pass a statute to keep the organizations that were identified within there without the being in the political realm. And so I agree, and I don't think it should be changed. I think President Trump's headed down the wrong road. I think when he sees the reaction in the country and the reaction in the Congress, he'll probably change direction. So I can't support a change there. And I think one of the things that America is so great for is our religious diversity. I mean, if we went around this room now and had everybody, and I'm not going to do it, but have everybody talk about their spiritual side, their religious side, we would find incredible diversity. And what we try to do in accordance with our Constitution is keep that separate from our government. And so I think it's a good idea, this provision and the other kinds of court rulings and things that have happened to interpret that amendment to have this division between church and state, because most of the wars that have been fought all around the world are usually fought over religion. And so I think it's a good idea. It is, well, it probably works in family politics. A lot of people say at the family dinners and the reunions, they say, you know, we don't talk about politics and we don't talk about religion. So it's probably a good idea to keep those two separated. Thank you. Thank you.
I came from an unusual family. We were encouraged to talk politics and religion at the dinner table. But I agree wholeheartedly with Senator Udall that we should not change the law as it stands today. I think it would end up politicizing religion more than the other way around. And I think we have a long history in this country of respecting all religions, the choice as to whether or not to participate in any religion or which one. That religious freedom is fundamental to who we are as a country and why we've made it for well over 200 years, despite the fact that, Senator Udall said, we've got a whole diverse set of views on religion in any given group that you put together. So, you know, my father, my pastor, myself, we used to sit around the table late at night talking about history and culture and religion, and that's a great thing. But I don't think it's good to mix politics and religion, particularly in an officially sanctioned way.
Okay, we now move to our first social media question. This is on climate. And we'll begin with Senator Heinrich for the answer. Leslie from Twitter asks, given the reality of the climate crisis, when do our policies shift to just get off fossil fuels as soon as possible? Senator Heinrich.
I want to say thank you for the question. I hope this is something people care a lot about. It is very much one of the things that motivates me to be involved in public service, because I have two little boys who are 10 and 14, and the world that they're going to inherit is markedly different than the world that all of us grew up in. If you read the news today, there were incredible stories about breaking ice sheets in Greenland, about literally watersheds shifting course between Canada and Alaska, things that happen normally on a geological timescale. That is what we're leaving to our children, and we owe it to them to address it. It is science, it is fact, and we have to do something about it. The question is, how can we get there as expeditiously as possible? There's a lot of risk associated with climate change, and it's easy to get down and out about that, but there's a lot of opportunity too. I worked very hard at the end of 2015 to craft a deal that, even though we were not in the Democratic side of the Senate, in charge of the Senate, we were able to get a deal that extended wind and solar tax credits, and not just for a year for a change, but for multiple years so that business could invest and plan over time. The results of that have been dramatic. We are seeing solar grow incredibly fast in the state of New Mexico. We are seeing wind investments that are like nothing we've seen in decades in rural communities, where hundreds and hundreds of megawatts, 5 projects right now in the state of New Mexico, 3 in Curry County, 1 in Torrance County, 1 in Roosevelt County, add up to more than a massive nuclear power plant's worth of new clean energy because of good policy. We owe it to our kids to accelerate that and to get as many good jobs out of it as we possibly can, because if we don't lead the solution to our climate challenges, then we're ceding that leadership to other countries who are more than happy to create those jobs someplace else.
Thank you, Martin. I agree. I'm going to be really quick so we can keep getting questions, but I agree with everything Martin said. The one thing I would congratulate him on, if you read the journal in the last couple of days, he's working with the city of Albuquerque to make sure they put solar panels on all their city buildings. So, and he teamed up with some his former colleagues on the city councilor to move that along. And that's what we need to be doing all across the United States, whether it's solar panels or painting things white, or a lot of municipalities decide to go in to generate power themselves, and they do it with renewable sources. And so there's a lot of options for all of you to get engaged in. The one thing that I really feel strongly about is that the Paris Agreement, we're at the table now. We help bring people at the table. This issue has been around with us for a very long time. Somebody told me about when my dad was in the cabinet with President Kennedy and Johnson, there was a specific thing back in the 1960s predicting exactly what was going to happen now. So it's been with us a long time. We've all pulled it together, and around the world and almost all the countries in the world are at the table and part of the Paris Agreement. To walk away from the Paris Agreement would be like sticking a sword into the climate change effort that's going to save us. And we can't allow that to happen. And I hope you'll back us and do everything you can to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Okay. We have our first written question now from the audience. It's on Syria, and we're going to begin with Senator Udall. Lucari asks, in light of the recent chemical attacks in Syria, what stance do you take on the refugee crisis, and what action do you think the United States should take?
You bet. And thank you for that question. We can't look the person in the eye, but thank you. The refugee crisis is if you study this, I'm on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, at a massive level around the world, the highest level we've ever seen it. And so I think it's an obligation on the countries that are richer to help out with this. I'm very proud that I was baptized in the Mormon Church in Utah. The thing that they were so grumpy with Trump about is that they have this incredible, now this is probably the most conservative state in the nation, they have this incredible refugee effort to take in refugees, and I've toured up there and seen it. It's amazing. All of the rich countries in the world should be helping out, and America should do its fair share on that, okay? And one of the things that we need to do is have smart foreign policy in the Middle East. I don't believe that tweets and threats and bombs are going to solve the problem in the Middle East. And you're going to see me be speaking up about the kinds of policies that I think we should engage in. And one of them should be that Assad, who's gassing these children and women and innocent people, he's going to be brought to account for that. And he's going to be brought to account in a war tribunal, and he's going to be brought to justice. And I guarantee you that. It may take a while, but it's going to happen, okay? And we just need to be patient about that and not get all riled up about that it doesn't happen immediately, because these really bad folks that are surrounded by military and that end up having countries like Iran and Russia helping them can preserve themselves for a while, but eventually they're going to be brought to justice. Thank you very much for that question. I spanned it a little bit, I apologize, but all of those issues I think are related to the refugee issue, because the core there has to do with the war that's dislocating the people and creating the refugees.
I think I want to recognize the work that Senator Udall has done on the Foreign Relations Committee, because it is strategic and thoughtful, and that is what we're lacking right now. We don't have a strategy in the White House for how to deal with this. We have trial by error foreign policy. You don't do trial by error with North Korea and Syria and Iran. We need to be projecting predictability, and we need to be working with our allies to achieve the goals that Senator Udall articulated in these cases. And it's very troubling to me to watch a president who is very confused about who our friends are and who our enemies are. It is not because people are Muslim that we should be fearful. It is because they are terrorists that we should be fearful. And we should have policies that make sure that terrorists and extremists cannot immigrate to the United States or come here via any pathway, refugee or otherwise. But we should be working with the people in that region who have the same goals and aspirations as we do. And when he sets up a refugee policy that basically slams the door on places like Jordan, who have shouldered an enormous burden of refugees, as Syria has lost, you know, a giant percentage of its population to this incredible conflict. Those are exactly the countries that we need to be working with, who are really on our side. So the thing I worry about most is the lack of a strategy and the lack of recognition that will only be successful in dealing with, whether it's Syria, whether it's Western Iraq, where ISIS currently exists. We can do these things only if we work together with the international community. The people on the ground who can change things are not American soldiers. They're the people who live in that region, who own it. We need to support them. But we should have learned the lessons of walking into Afghanistan or walking into Iraq and thinking that we were going to be the security services for the entire country. That doesn't work. So my hope is that the country is going to wake up to just how erratic the foreign policy is under the current administration, and we will be able to pass an authorization to use the military force that finally puts some guardrails on this and articulates what our policy is,
what our strategic goals are instead of this trial by error approach. In the interest of time, I will ask our audience to try to minimize applause throughout the program so that we can get to as many questions as possible. We have our next question here, and if you could say your name and where you're from.
Hello, Tom Olson is my name. I'm from Las Cruces. My question is this. President Obama, before he abandoned the issue, and candidate Clinton seemed to favor the Simpson-Bowles Commission strategy of saving, and I use that word incredulously, Social Security by raising retirement ages, cutting benefits, and some form of privatization. Yet it is widely known that virtually all of Social Security's future problems could be resolved simply by lifting the cap on the Social Security payroll tax, a solution which is included, as you know, in the New Mexico Democratic Party platform. Where do you stand?
Senator Heinrich, we begin with you on that.
First off, Social Security is not the root of all of our budget woes. And we've been borrowing from Social Security surpluses until recently for a long time. So the idea that we should blame Social Security, and Tom is not doing that, but I have seen my colleagues do that, for our budget woes is a mistake. And I believe that in order to keep Social Security solvent, that somebody who makes several hundred thousand dollars a year or more in income, that we should look at charging them the same Social Security rate that they charge a plumber or an electrician or a teacher. What he said, raise the cap and keep Social Security solvent. That's how we fix this situation. I think we've done an awful lot of cutting in recent years to help make our federal budget balance. And we're at a point where we have the bare minimum for many of our agencies that are truly important to places like the state of New Mexico. It's worth looking at whether middle-income people who are already shouldering a huge amount of tax burden, lower-income people are shouldering a huge amount of tax burden, if there aren't places where we also need to add revenues to make that more fair so that you don't have somebody who makes $1 million a year who pays a lower tax percentage than somebody who makes $50,000 a year. I don't think we're getting that balance right now. And the last thing we should do is weaken Social Security by increasing the retirement age or cutting back the benefits. It is the fundamental thing that has created a middle class retirement for an entire nation.
Tom, to make it simple for you, I agree with Martin, and let's move on to the next question.
Right. And we'll do that.
Hi, my name is Lucas Hernan. I'm from here in Las Cruces. I want to thank you both for being here, and I also want to thank KRWG for hosting the event and broadcasting live. They actually had me on the radio last week talking about local activism and how folks can stay active and how they can utilize local political action into political movements. And based on something Senator Heinrich said in the beginning about staying involved in the local races, I think you both know that I fully believe and support to the point that I work for that full time. But I do see a lot of frustration in people locally, how they can feel involved and feel like they're making a difference at the federal level. So out here in Las Cruces, when we find out that, you know, we're dropping bombs on Syria and a lot of us don't like that, you know, we show up in front of the courthouse and we hold signs and we feel okay, but what do we really do to affect change at the federal level? If you have some ideas for people listening, people here tonight, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you very much. And I think one of the things we need to be thinking, you know, over the years as we move along, and this is a very big picture issue, is what you're identifying, is people feel much closer to their government at the local level. And to the extent that the federal government can always be evaluating how we make sure that local governments have the revenue to do the things that they need to do and do things closer at home, I think is a good idea. And so that's not directly answering your question, but I think, you know, the federal government is so powerful and sometimes so big that we need to look at that mix. But we're always going to need to be there in the environmental area and defense and immigration and all these other things that are for the country as a whole. But a good example in terms of helping out. I mean, a lot of people that study these things say, look around the country. You know, you may on the issue on Syria and Russia say, you know, we know how Heinrich and Udall are going to go. And we know how Pierce is going to go. And so within this congressional district, and you can, you know, you got both sides of the issue to work on there, you know, either, and so you can have some impact because you have some difference in opinion here. But if you don't have any difference at all, you have friends all over the country. You can network in an incredible way. The thing that I can tell you, elected members care the most about is hearing from a constituent. So if you have a friend that, like you, feels the same way in Florida, and that friend calls up Bill Nelson or Marco Rubio, they're going to listen to him, or they're going to listen to the letter. And so you have an ability to network there. Don't just think of change politically. Many of us now, and there are many in this audience that are in the stock market. You get, as a shareholder, you get to participate in change in terms of what happens in corporations. One of the things right now that I think threatens our society the most, and it was kind of alluded to in the question on the Johnson Amendment, is all the money in politics. Well, you could demand from the corporations that you're a shareholder that every single dime they spend on politics is public and transparent, and it's part of their annual reports. Because that would move us towards getting at the dark money that's out there in terms of Citizens United. And I've always been for trying to move us towards getting the money out of politics, especially the big money and the dark money, and move in the direction of public financing. So we need you involved and engaged in so many different ways. I mean, now you have social media where you can get involved. There are so many ways. If there are indivisible folks here, those visits you make to my staff, folks since this election have been coming every week to my office in Santa Fe, my office in Albuquerque, my office in Las Cruces, maybe other offices too, and giving us your reaction of what's happened the last week. And I learn about it from my staff. They come out, they talk to you, they listen to you. That makes a difference. You're heard. So don't feel that you don't have a voice. You do have a voice in this democracy, and in particular you have a voice. You're in a state with 2 million people and two senators here. Look over in California, they got 40 million people or whatever, and they got two senators too. So I like the ratio for you. Okay.
I agree, Lucas. It's like I can guarantee you, if you go to one of those big states, New York or Florida or California, your odds of running into your senator at the grocery store are a little lower than in New Mexico. So we want to hear from you. But I would also say those local races, they matter. And not just in terms of what happens on your school board and what policy the school board sets or what happens at your county commission, what they decide. They also set the entire tone for those of us who are working at the federal level. There are days when I really miss my time on city council when I only needed to count to five. It's a lot easier to count to five than to 60. But I can tell you that this activism that is happening in our country right now, it sets a tone for what is possible and for where we go from here. So, both politically and through other social organizations, that nonprofits and other ways of making sure that you're building the kind of community that you want to be a part of. Those things make a big difference, and they trickle up, not down, to how we end up behaving in Washington, D.C. as well.
Okay, and our next question will begin with Senator Heinrich.
Perfect, because you're the one I'd like to ask. My name is Sandra Marie. I live in Doñana. And since you're on the Senate Intelligence Committee, I would like to get your comments on the Louise Mensch report that came out yesterday that says that our intelligence allies in both England and Germany have turned over documentation and tapes to our intelligence agencies that show that Donald Trump himself and members of his administration did collude with Russia on the campaign, and how soon will our country be taking action?
Sandra Marie, thank you very much for this question. I did not ask to serve on the Senate Intelligence Committee. I was assigned there, and boy, what a ride it has been. I have learned a lot. There is nothing that I've seen, and there have been some things I'm very proud of that we've accomplished in part on that committee. For example, the American intelligence community apparatus and agencies are no longer holding your telephone metadata as a matter of policy in this country anymore. We're focusing on people who commit crimes or do terrorism and not surveilling innocent, law-abiding Americans. So we've gotten some important things done on that committee. Nothing is more important than getting to the bottom of the question that you raised. I cannot talk about the details of much of what I've seen and what we're doing, but this investigation is ongoing. It is a primary focus of my efforts in Washington, D.C. right now. We are working very hard to maintain it as a bipartisan investigation, because I think that will be important for the American people to take it credibly. And I can tell you that it is absolutely moving forward. There are some things I can say that are not classified, that if they don't concern you, boy, I don't know what it takes to make you worried about the world that we live in. There are 1,000, give or take, people in Russia that they employ to be trolls. Trolls are people who then influence social media. They can pretend to be somebody else from Iowa or New Mexico and influence the conversation on social media to create certain stories that trend and certain stories that don't. They buy bots. They create fake social media accounts so that they can once again impact what trends and what doesn't trend. This has a very real impact on the media that shows up on your phone, because once enough of these cycles of amplification or de-amplification occur, suddenly you're reading a story that has no bearing on the facts, but a lot of people are forwarding and a lot of people are reading because of these sophisticated techniques. We had, and this was confirmed by all of the top leadership of the American intelligence community in an open hearing, the Russians were in our state-level voter databases. Now, I have seen no evidence that they changed that data, that they took people off those rolls or changed the data associated with them. But if they were inside those rolls, that should worry the devil out of all of us. So we've got another set of elections coming up in 2 years, and then we've got a set after that. The chairman, the Republican chairman of the Intelligence Committee, said today or yesterday, I think, he said it's fair to assume that the Russians are now involved in the French elections. We've seen this in country after country. We have to get sophisticated about this. Some of my colleagues have also been to the Baltics and places like Estonia and Latvia. They've been dealing with this for a long time, disinformation within their elections. We need to understand what happened. We need to know the extent to, if there was any collusion, then we should document that and we should deal with that. And what I will pledge to you is that we are not going to stop looking until we understand exactly what happened.
And I agree with everything, Sandra Marie, everything Martin said. The only thing I want to add is that, and I think he's one of the most intelligent, thoughtful, persistent, hardworking members of that committee. And it's proceeding bipartisan, but the big question's going to be how much the country gets to know, or even I get to know, in terms of what comes out of this report. And so I would just recommend to all of you, I wouldn't give up on a 9/11 type commission where complete, you all know the 9/11 commission. This would be completely bipartisan. It would be really distinguished people from around the country that come together and look at what happened in the election, what specifically happened on the collusion, and what should we do to make sure it doesn't happen in the next election. And so I'm pushing for that. I'm on legislation to do that. And I think we all should keep pushing for that. But I'm rooting for Mark Warner and Richard Burr, who are the chairman and vice chairman. Mark Warner actually said about this investigation, he's a very good, thoughtful senator. He said, this is the most important thing I'm doing in my life. And so and it's great having Martin there working with all of them to get this done. But let's not... Let's be persistent about making sure that we find out what happened and how to make sure that no foreign country ever colludes in our election again or gets involved in our election again, and let's get that corrected. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Udall, our next question is from Twitter, and it is this. How will you deal with administration demands that federal dollars will be used to fund the wall?
The first big fight over the wall came with the what's called a supplemental appropriations bill, and the Trump administration, been a long time since we've seen a supplemental. We have a lot of budget dysfunction, but a supplemental bill came up to the tune of $54 billion, and part of that had the wall in it. And I'm very proud that all of the Democrats have united and talked about, we don't, in our budgeting, you know, if you want to pass an individual bill and do your wall, in the budgeting bill, we don't want it in there. And actually, Mitch McConnell has taken this supplemental, the $54 billion supplemental, and he's just put it aside. He says, we don't want to deal with that right now. We've got our main budget issues that we need to, actually, when we come back on April 28th, the budget exhausts, because we're in a six-month CR, and we have to put a budget bill in for the rest of the fiscal year that would go all the way up to October the 1st. So Mitch McConnell has said, we're not going to deal with that now, and the Democrats have been very united. Don't put that money in there. And so that's the position we're maintaining now. I believe it is it's a solid position. Just to go a little bit further in terms of the wall, I think if you've flown the border and been on the border and you understand what's there now and the technology's there, we've done a pretty good job in terms of making sure that we're not having violations of the border. And you can tell that in the statistics. Just look up what the statistics are. We're actually hitting very high levels in terms of the progress about what's happened. So the wall would be a waste of money, in my opinion. There are better ways to do this if we're going to work on security, and we should be focusing on what the big issues are facing our country as a whole, like education and health care and the things I hear about every day from you that when you come to my office and when you email me. Thank you.
It's a great question. I don't have a lot to add to what Senator Udall just said, other than to say that the president gets to propose things, but Congress gets to dispose. And we are going to set a different set of priorities. And I will tell you, I've had a lot of conversations, as has Senator Udall, with Border Patrol agents all along that southern border, with people in border communities, with ranchers who work on the border and have to deal with the very real challenges each and every day. The number one, the number two, the number three thing that I've been asked for has not been a wall. And we will make additional investments to help secure the border, but to do it in a way that is smart and realistic and is responsive to the very real needs of the people whose job it is to get that work done.
Okay. We have our next question. It's from the audience, and it's from Carol in Las Cruces. Carol begins by saying thank you for all of your support in fighting Neil Gorsuch and Trump's cabinet appointments. Carol's question, though, is about something that has been introduced and reintroduced for many, many years in the House of Representatives, and that is a bill that would guarantee health care for all Americans. The shorthand is in her question, and we'll begin with you, Senator Heinrich. Carol asks, will you support Medicare for all?
Thank you. I want to first thank her for the question. I think this is, we are at a point right now where personally I'm willing to look at any plan that I believe strengthens or expands Medicare because it's one of the things that functionally works within our healthcare system. But our first and foremost point of order right now, because we're in the minority and Mitch McConnell gets to decide what goes on the floor of the Senate, is to make sure that we don't lose any of the gains that we have made under the ACA. And I know the ACA doesn't go far enough on a number of fronts, and I know it's not perfect. There are things that aren't working well in it. The premiums are too high, co-pays are too high. We should fix those things. But we should never go back to the time where you can't stay on your parents' plan until you're 26. You don't get to be covered because you have a pre-existing condition. I mean, you have diabetes, so you shouldn't be able to buy insurance. We should not go back to that era. And we're going to fight very, very hard to make sure that in this time when Paul Ryan controls what's on the floor in the House of the Representatives and Mitch McConnell controls what goes onto the floor of the Senate, that we don't lose any of the things that we accomplished in that health care legislation. And then hopefully we'll be in a position in the majority in a couple of years to go back and look at how can we strengthen Medicare? How can we strengthen Medicaid? We lost Medicaid expansion. We'd lose something like 250,000 people. If we repealed, passed their repeal and replace plan for what they call Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, over 250,000 New Mexicans would find themselves without health care. Think about what that does to a rural hospital. You know, the rural hospitals stepped up a few years ago. When we passed that legislation, they voluntarily took lower reimbursement rates for what they do. In exchange, we said, we're going to cover everybody. We're going to do Medicaid expansion. You're not going to have so many people in the emergency room getting their primary care, so many people getting indigent care that have to be paid for either by the hospital or your county taxes. That would be, if we had passed the bill that they almost passed in the House of Representatives, rural hospitals across this country would have closed. So we're going to fight as hard as we can to hang on to the things we've accomplished, and then we're going to look forward to say, how can we go even further?
Martin, thank you for that answer, and I agree with him. We really have a big fight on our hands right now with the Affordable Care Act, and I just want to point out one additional statistic. When we went into this 8 years ago, New Mexico had the highest uninsured in the country. We've cut it in half with the Affordable Care Act, and so we've made some big gains, and he talked about the others, pre-existing conditions, lifetime limits. You go through those. We've made real, real progress. And the core of your question, I believe the core of this question is, do you support the idea of every American having health care? The answer to that for me is yes, okay? And every year I've been in public service, that's what I've been fighting for. That's what I've been fighting for. Every one of our citizens having health care. The question is how you get there. And if it takes getting there, improving on the Affordable Care Act, if it takes expanding Medicare, I've fought for and been on a bill to take Medicare down from 65 to 55 and take that group and move in that direction. We had this debate before the Affordable Care Act. We had a public option. One of the things you may not know is that in the health care bill that we passed, the Affordable Care Act, there is a public option for states. And so you have a gubernatorial election coming up. You should be asking every one of those candidates, are you going to take the public option that is in the Affordable Care Act and make it a reality in New Mexico? So you can do a lot here. We're going to keep working hard at the federal level to make sure everybody's covered with health care.
Our next question from the audience.
Hi, my name is John Fenner, and I'm a new Las Cruces. I was really kind of curious about, speaking for me, when I see everything that's going on right now, it almost seems hopeless that we're really going to get a lot done on our agenda for the next 2 years. I was just wondering, since you're in the Congress so often, have you heard from any of your Republican colleagues? Is there any kind of like chink in the armor where any of them are starting to lose confidence in this particular administration and possibly can start seeing some people stand up to our current president?
And for John's question, we'll begin with Senator Udall.
Yeah. I think you need to, you all know John McCain, right? Yeah, neighbor next door. John McCain and Lindsey Graham in the foreign policy area have been pretty outstanding in terms of speaking out and speaking truth to power to the president. There were people that joined with me. Martin joined with me very early on when we reformed the toxic chemicals bill. And everybody came together. We had an agency, the Environmental Protection Agency, that hadn't regulated toxic chemicals for 25 years because of a court ruling. And we actually, in 3 years of work, I was the lead on this with another Republican. We pulled everybody together. We only had 4 votes against it in the House and not a single vote against it in the Senate. So we stood it back up. And what I'm fearful of now is, will those same Republicans join with me to support the EPA to continue forward? So there are some Republican voices to reach out to. We are always, I think I can speak for Martin on this, and he's a great networker and organizer, working with fellow colleagues. We're always reaching out. And I think, just to tell you one little story, I can't tell you the name of the senator because it's kind of, because you're, part of your question is saying, are they beginning to change their minds? There's a senator who's one of the most astute politicos in the whole Senate, and he says he has what he calls Trumpites. These are his friends within his constituency that he calls every couple of weeks and says, how's it going? How do you think the administration's doing? And this, over Easter weekend, one of them, who was a law enforcement guy, went to Easter dinner, and he told everybody there, you know, Trump wasn't fulfilling his promises, and he was very worried about what was happening to the country. And I think there is kind of a reckoning coming around in terms of what's happening. And, you know, to use, it's kind of paraphrasing what Martin said, they're kind of learning on the job, and I think people expect it a lot better. I think they expected people to be hired around him who were going to educate him and move him in the right direction. And then what they saw is billionaires and millionaires who made a lot of money with him and had all these contacts. Those are the folks that are there, and it looks like they're not necessarily out on many of these issues at this point for the American people. They're more out for themselves. And so I hope that answered your question, John. I'm trying to deal with different parts of it there. But thank you very much for your question. Really appreciate it.
John, I'll just add just a little bit. In private conversations, I've had many conversations where individual senators have said, oh boy, we've got some issues here. That's different than going to the floor of the Senate and directly challenging the sitting president. And I think a lot of them feel caught between their base and an administration who's making some very deep mistakes right now. I mean, this is an administration who promised to drain the swamp. Draining the swamp is a good thing. The swamp's getting deeper, folks. I mean, the lack of transparency, we're not going to hire lobbyists, but then we're going to give waivers to lobbyists to come work for us. It's frustrating. Those things frustrate, I think, people across the political spectrum. And we do have a number of senators who on individual issues have come forward. I mean, you saw Senator Murkowski and Senator Collins step up on the Betsy DeVos vote. If we'd had one more senator, she would not be our Secretary of Education right now. I mean, how embarrassing is it that she is our Secretary of Education? But we're literally one senator short on some of these things from getting to the point where we can change course. And we need to be open to joining those senators who are willing to have the courage to say, on this issue, my president, my party, wrong course. And we will continue to reach out to people and hope that on some of these places where they're truly out of step with American values, that somebody's willing to do that.
Okay, our next question.
Hi, Senators. Carol Hauseman from Las Cruces. First of all, I want to thank you both for being here because you're very accessible to your constituents, and I know that's not the case in all the states this recess. Senator Udall, I want to thank you for not supporting the recent bombing in Syria and coming out against it. I think that was the right thing to do. I don't think it accomplished anything but allowing Trump to grandstand. Senator Heinrich, I need to know why you didn't support it. I just need to know your reasoning, your thinking, because it was the first time I was very disappointed in a decision you made, and I would like to know why you supported Trump's decision, even though you said next time he needs to come before the Congress for approval, and we all know that probably won't happen. I just need to know your reasoning for what you did.
It's Carol, right?
Yes, Carol. One of the things, if I'm going to give my answer here, but if you have the time, and you can probably find this on my website, if you go back to 2013, you'll see the first time I wrestled with this issue. And I absolutely understand where you're coming from. I think before I was in the Intelligence Committee, I would probably be in the exact same place. What I have seen in Bashar al-Assad is a very calculating and terrible human being who is willing to use certain weapons as more as political weapons against the resistances in his country than as military weapons. So what I've had to stare in the face in briefing after briefing is Bashar al-Assad deciding to test the international community, to gas 50 people and see if there's any response. And if there's not, then to gas 100 people and to see if there's any response. And then if there's not, to gas 500 people. He does this very meticulously. I do not trust the current president to have the right approach to get to where we need to be in Syria, which I think Senator Udall articulated very well. This is somebody who should be prosecuted for war crimes. And Syria will not have a political solution to the current strife as long as he is in place there. It's also important to realize ISIS will not go away until he's not there, because he is the number one thing that recruits new people to ISIS in Syria, is a reaction to his, the way he treats the people of Syria. So I believe it's appropriate to send a limited military message that says, we're not going to just sit back. We're going to take your capacity away, whether it means taking the helicopters sitting on the runway that are used to deploy those weapons off the table, or to put a hole in a runway so that they can't be used. That's a very different thing than saying, well, we should just get involved in another ground war in the Middle East and send in American troops. I support sending the message that it is inconceivable that the international community would allow him to act with impunity. That does not mean I trust the current commander-in-chief to be able to deal with this situation and get us where we need to be in Syria.
Okay, we have about 35 minutes left in our program this evening to give you an idea of where we're at, and we have another question.
Hi, my name is Haley McDonald, and I live in Las Cruces, New Mexico. My question was very similar to the last question, so I will just ask more of a pointed question. Both of you have called on Trump to go to Congress and ask for an updated authorization from the 9/11. How would you vote if he asked for that? Would you vote no and stop these endless wars and learn from our mistakes in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Libya? Or vote yes and let this reckless, hot-headed president march us onto another war?
This is me, right? Haley, very, very good question. First of all, let's take the historical context of where we are, which is, remember when President Obama came into office, he felt that like his mission was to wind down these wars that we were in. And he did it in, I believe, a smart way, in a thoughtful way. And he had us going down. I mean, the numbers, if you go to the high numbers of troops in Afghanistan and then the withdrawal, which the Iraqis asked for, of having the troops come out, he was moving in the direction of ending it all. And I was in support of that. What's happened now with this administration is we're actually jacking that all up in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and now we're over in Syria also. So we're headed on a completely different path. And that's the reason to ask for an authorization of force debate, is to come specifically to terms as to what the administration wants to do and what are the time limits. We actually voted in the Foreign Relations Committee on one of these to try to, and we tried to trim it in and say, and one of my amendments was to say every year, first of all, you have to report every month a lot in a lot more detail of exactly what's going on in terms of the costs, in terms of the lives being lost, and all of that. And then secondly, make sure that the American people understand how the war's being prosecuted. And so I thought if you force Congress with saying every year you have to come back, they then have to come to grips with the situation. The unfortunate situation we have now is Congress has completely abdicated the war-making authority, completely abdicated, because the you can't declare war on another country unless Congress does it. No president can do it. And so we're in a situation now where we're in violation of the Constitution and the war-making powers in the Constitution. With regard to Syria, in my opinion. And so that we're trying to force the issue. Unfortunately, what's happened is presidents just use these really old, and I voted for the authorization of force on Al-Qaeda on 9/11. I was in the Congress, and I thought we should go over, we should have a strike. President Bush, if you remember him, President Bush outlining the objectives, we achieved all of his objectives in 60 days. We should have been in there, achieved our objectives, and come home, and then supported them in whatever way we could with security forces, diplomacy, and everything else to let them put their country back together rather than us doing the things that we've done over there. So does that give you an answer to your question? You want to follow up a little bit? I mean, I would be for it. If it's an authorization of force against Syria, that's one issue, or an authorization of force to wind it up and wrap it down in terms of ISIS, that's another authorization of force. You can combine them together, but the country has to have this debate of where we want to go. And I have a lot of constituents telling me, you know, they like the path President Obama was on, and they remember candidate Trump, now President Trump, saying on the campaign trail, we're going to hit them hard a couple of times, and then we're bringing the troops home because we got better things to do. And so they and use the term, you hear the term over and over again, we're not going to have endless wars. People are contacting me all the time and say, we are in an endless war. When are we going to end this? And we have to end it smartly, and we have to make sure that we do everything we can to protect innocent people in these countries. But that's where I am on it, and we're working hard to do it. But boy, it's hard as one or two senators and members of Congress, where the Congress just says, oh, you go do what you want, and if you make a mistake, we'll criticize you. But we're not going to weigh into the middle of it. We should be in the middle of it. And just like when the Congress shut down Vietnam, when it was sick and tired, it was Congress that voted, said, we're finished, the funding's being cut off, bring the men and women home. So that's where I am anyway.
Haley, I don't have a lot to add to that. I think that Senator Udall has it completely right. We have allowed a broad authorization of use of military force from well over a decade ago to become an authorization for anything. And so what I would like to see us do is say, do we have a strategy and what should it look like, and not have this endless open situation that we currently find ourselves in. And the only way that's going to happen is if Congress steps up and passes something that's a lot more narrow than what we currently have. And I have strongly supported the efforts that Senator Udall, as well as people like Tim Kaine from Virginia, have led on the Foreign Relations Committee to do that.
And Senator Heinrich, our next question is from Twitter. We'll begin with you. How can we stop Trump from rolling back monuments?
So, first off, you know, I have an enormous amount of respect for the office, and so I always try to force myself to say President Trump because it's the right thing to do. I'm very close to this one, as Senator Udall can attest to. I used to be an outfitter guide. There's nothing closer to my heart than the time that I've spent with my wife and my kids in New Mexico's public lands. Some of our best memories have been made in what is now Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks National Monument, as well as Rio Grande del Norte National Monument in northern New Mexico. I think probably the most important thing that we can do is to make it incredibly clear to Secretary Zinke and to the President that this is a battle that they don't want to have. They're on the losing end of a whole bunch of battles right now, and they're having a hard time focusing on what's next and showing that they can actually govern. And the louder that we as local individuals who care about our backyard, and boy, Las Cruces has the most, you can't see it for the wall, but I know right over there is one of the most scenic backdrops in the world. The more you can stand up and say, this is ours, we created it here at the local community, they may not come for those fights. So I encourage you to do that. I think the biggest fight we're going to have that over potentially using the Antiquities Act in an activist way that it was never designed for. If you read the Antiquities Act, it's like two paragraphs when laws could be written in half a page. It says what you can do under the Antiquities Act. It actually does not articulate undoing protections under the Antiquities Act. So we'll cross those bridges when we have to, too, if it comes to legal action. But I think, personally, it is our activism, it is our voice that matters more than anything else.
I agree with everything he said. I'm very proud of the work we've done on the Rio Grande del Norte, on the Oregon Peaks, Oregon Mountains, Desert Peaks, and so let's move forward, Fred.
Okay.
Another question.
And our next question will begin with you, Senator Udall. It's about the State Department. How do you feel about recent cuts to the State Department? Don't you believe the U.S. needs increased diplomacy in light of all foreign policy issues, not less?
You know, the answer is yes. You want me to go on? Let me just say, General Mattis, who has been around a long time, they call him the warrior monk. He, on this issue of the cut, which was a very significant cut to foreign aid, he says, if you're going to cut there, he says, you got to give me more ammunition. And he's the biggest advocate for having a robust foreign policy. Do folks here know how much of the federal budget we spend on foreign aid? It's less than 1%. Less than 1%. And President Trump is talking about slashing some of those programs up to 50%. So it's not a wise move. It's not a smart thing to be doing. And the Defense Department even supports, as I said, through General Mattis, even supports the level of funding that we have right now. And there's an organization here in New Mexico, it's a nationwide organization that's working to build the support for this among the people. And I think it's already there, but they're working harder to build it and make it stronger. Thank you very much.
I don't have a lot to add. I sit on the Senate Armed Services Committee, so Secretary Mattis comes in front of us. All those generals at the Pentagon, they all come in front of us. If you ask them, should we be cutting the State Department, they'll tell you no, because they know that the things that happen there are absolutely essential for them to be successful as well. So no, we should not be cutting the State Department. It is with the level of international upheaval that we're seeing today, this is not the time to be defunding the State Department.
Okay, next question.
Thank you. Hello, can you hear me? Okay. My name is Marjorie Vella. I live in Las Cruces. I am currently a PhD student at New Mexico State University, and I study water science and management. I look at health disparities along the U.S.-Mexico border that are caused by water quality issues. And there's a lot of unrest in the scientific world right now. We are really scared that we are losing funding left and right at the federal level. And so my question to you is, how do you plan to protect those funds and to help continue to diversify the scientific community?
All right, and we'll begin with Senator Heinrich.
Thank you for speaking out on behalf of science. As somebody who started out as an engineer, I like to say that it doesn't matter whether or not you believe in science, the data suggests it works really well. And it has served our country really well for over 200 years that we have been a country rooted in the scientific method. And when you look at what has made our country successful on a whole scale of levels, it has been the fact that we have invested in basic research, in education, and in infrastructure. And from that, our private sector has been able to do all the other good things that grow our economy and grow jobs. Defunding that research is ridiculously short-sighted. Now, fortunately, I get to represent a state like New Mexico, who does a lot of things with national laboratories, with NASA up the road here. So we have a lot of people on both sides of the political spectrum who value science. But it's just as important that we support things like NIH, that is basically the biological equivalent of our national laboratories, or the National Renewable Energy Labs up in Colorado. You know, these are the things that produce the basic research that then we can use to compete in the world and to solve the incredible challenges that we have. We're going to fight like the Dickens to hang on to the funding. The thing that worries me more than the funding is the effort right now to discredit science as an institution and a methodology. That worries me far more than the short-term efforts to defund a particular agency. And we have to make sure that our schools and our universities and all of us as citizens continue to stand up and say, hey, I may not be a scientist, but science has sure served our country really well for a long time, and we need to continue to teach the scientific method and hold true to that.
Bravo, Martin. I agree with everything he said. Marjorie, the only suggestion to everyone here, all of you clapping, join the march on Saturday. There's a march on Saturday. Thank you.
That's right.
Yeah.
March for science. All right. We have another question.
Well, welcome to Las Cruces. My name is Linda Harris, and I've lived here about 40 years, and then in El Paso before that. Almost every day I read in the Albuquerque Journal, I see pictures of young people who have died suddenly. They're 19, they're 23, almost every single day. And New Mexico has, I believe, the second highest death rate of overdoses for opioid addiction. And so my question is this. the current administration is going to cut funding through the healthcare system for treatment for drug addiction. And then the second thing is they're talking about then punitive treatment and putting these young people in jail. So if they're not dying, they're being spending their lives in jail. So my question is, you know, what can you do against the pharmaceutical companies that are pushing these prescription drugs or the treatment? How are you going to push back against what looks like the administration is going to do?
Senator Udall.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. The issue, first of all, and I go back to the gentleman's question here about bipartisanship and do you see any hope? I mean, just before the last election, we passed a bill with $900 million to deal with the opioid crisis, which is significant funding. And as you've announced, the Trump administration intends to try to roll that back. So we're going to fight tooth and nail to make sure that we maintain that great bipartisan effort. It's called the Cures Act, if you want to look it up and see a little bit more about it. And it gets money out into all the states and is very is going to make, I think, significant progress if we can keep that. The other thing we need to do that you bring up is about young people and drug abuse and just drug abuse overall in our society. And I'm a real big believer that we need to treat this as a public health problem. We don't need to criminalize this. If there are violent criminals and drugs, that's one situation. But we have many, many people in our prisons now that are nonviolent, and they're serving these very, very long sentences that are due to some kind of drug issue. And I think the best way to go is to focus on these things as a public health problem, as to focus the resources into that, and try to make sure that we start making progress and having fewer and fewer of our young people getting addicted and getting into substance abuse. Thank you.
You know, the scary thing being from some place that has suffered as much as New Mexico has is that all of us have been touched by this. We've had friends who've lost their daughter. We've had, you know, friends see their niece or their nephew overdose. So we need to treat this treatment first and foremost. And we need to recognize that treatment is not free. It requires funding. So we passed a really good policy bill maybe a year and a half ago. It was an important step. But it wasn't until the Cures Act that we actually put some money behind it. And the only, this is a public health epidemic across the country. And the only tiny good thing that's come out of that is places that used to look at the challenges that Senator Udall or I would talk about in terms of opioids, and it is that everybody's now been touched by this. And so it really is a bipartisan effort to do something about it. We need to stop approving so darn many new synthetic opiates. It's crazy. Some of these are so powerful. It's just, it's not in our interest. And we need to make sure that it's not easy to legally prescribe these for non-medical reasons. Now, there are people who have real medical pain issues, and we shouldn't take that away. But there are ways to track abuse that are good for everyone across the board and would really help lower the number of times that somebody has to, you know, go to a funeral and see some young person snuffed out at the best part of their life.
Our next question.
It's hard for me to speak. I don't know how to speak good. I'm a veteran of the 9th Infantry Division, Republic of Vietnam. I gave my life. And when I walk outside and I see those little kids playing, I say, God, if it's worth, if I had a chance, I'd do it again for those little kids' sake. I see my country very deeply divided at this particular time. And I say shame on you. Whether you be a Republican, whether you be a damn Democrat, whatever you are, if you're a Muslim, shame on you. You have to build bridges. Mr. Putin made the biggest deal in human history. He's sending $4 billion of oil and gas to China. Germany shut down their nuclear plants. He's sending it in the other direction. I don't know what the size of that deal is, but I'm sorry. He's here to stay, unless he dies or something.
Sir,
he's here to stay.
What's your name, sir?
Charles Madrid.
Charles, do you have a question now?
Are you trying to shield these gentlemen?
We have a little less than 10 minutes, and we have people standing for a long time. Do you have a question for one of the senators or both?
Okay, let me just make it brief. We debated in the election who was going to hold the buttons that are going to set off nuclear war, okay? Whether it was going to be Hillary or whether it was going to be Trump. I want to suggest to you that tonight, the gentleman that is holding those nuclear buttons is in North Korea, and he just told the Chinese ambassadors to get lost. Just came on my thing right now. We need unity at a time like this. You need to try to break bridges and build bridges with Putin. You need to try to build bridges between the people you hate.
Okay.
Now, if you're going...
Thank you, sir.
You know,
Senator Heinrich,
I don't mind a good lynching every now and then. I kind of like it. If you lynch this president, don't do it at an inconvenient time.
Okay.
Because this idiot might push the button.
We had
make sure he's still in place.
Sir, we had a minute limit, and
you
now
can
we're almost at 3 minutes. Senator,
I'm just, gentlemen, are you going to remember that you're Americans when it comes time for unity and problems?
Sir, thank you
Charles,
for your question.
I want to say, first and foremost, that the reality of how divided we are as a country is absolutely real, and furthering those divisions is not what is going to get us through these challenging times. And I will say I am very proud of the work that I have done with friends, not just colleagues, but friends on the other side of the aisle. And when the president acts in ways that I believe are consistent with our American values, I will partner with him. If he wants to do an infrastructure bill, for example, I think that's a place we can work together. We also have a tradition of being able to disagree in this country, and there will be issues, and you've heard some of them here tonight, where we will disagree, and we will not.
I represent one country.
Amen.
One country.
One country. You're absolutely right.
Thank you. Martin said it very well. I would just like, sir, thank you for your service to the country. I believe you served. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Thank you for your service. And we've had people waiting. Yes.
Yes. My name is Jerry Gunderson. I'm retired and I live in Las Cruces. And you talked about Medicare and Medicaid, and I appreciate your answers on that. There's one other program that I think that really deserves funding. I'm concerned about that. And that's called the New Mexico Aging and Long-Term Services. Can you explain how you plan on funding this program?
What was your first name?
Jerry.
Jerry. Are you talking about the Agency on Aging or the U.S., the federal law on aging that puts money into?
Correct.
Yeah. Well, that is a very important law. It funds many of the small agencies in New Mexico. If you go into our senior centers and you visit with the people that are running them, a lot of them talk about that law helping significantly. So I believe in it. I believe it's more of a partnership than anything between the state and the federal government to operate at that level. And I intend to fight and do everything I can to continue to see that the law has the resources behind it. Thank you. Thank you, Jared.
You know, we're running short on time. I don't disagree with anything that Senator Udall just said.
Okay, our next question.
Okay. First, I would like to take a brief moment to salute and thank everyone for being here. My name is Ariel Quintana. I'm Mexican-American or American-Mexican, born in El Paso, Texas, and raised on the other side of the border in Ciudad Juarez. Senator Heinrich, during your opening statement, you mentioned how the nation is polarized more than ever, which I agree. Now, as a citizen of the United States, or a resident of the enchanting state of New Mexico, or a member of the city of Las Cruces and the New Mexico State University community, how can we, the people, approach the issue of having such a broken and divided country?
It's an incredibly important question, and thank you for asking. I think it means, you know, one of the things I've learned from Senator Udall is within the context of the Senate, the House of Representatives, that disagreements don't mean that you don't have dialogue and conversation and friendships with people in those bodies that you disagree with. And I think as a nation, it's gotten a little too easy for all of us to consume our news from one particular soda straw. And we still need to sit down on the porch with our neighbor and realize that this is a big, diverse country and that we're going to have to work with people that we fundamentally disagree with on things. And that doesn't mean you got to like give up on your values. It means you work extra hard to find those places where you do agree. Maybe it's what we can do for our veterans. Maybe it's, you know, what we can do for our national labs or infrastructure. You know, almost every single person on the other side of the aisle, there's some place that we can work together. And I would say that if you divide the Senate, the way I would divide it in my head is not Republicans and Democrats. It's people who seek to be pragmatic and find a way to get things done. That's the example that I've followed and seen in Senator Udall. And then those folks who try to drive wedges. We've got enough wedges in this country right now. We're going to have plenty of things to disagree about. We have to work just as hard, if not harder, to find those places where we can work together.
And Martin has shown the same kind of approach I've seen in his service, City Council, House of Representatives, Congress. And let me make one additional point. What I'd found in many of my town hall meetings over the years, if you start talking about a specific issue, you know, and you really get into the issue, let's say health care in terms of getting people health care, and you have a good, robust discussion, you're going to find most of the time that you're going to have agreement in the range of about 80%. You know, that most people are going to kind of say, this is what I think we should strive for. And then our job is to try to do, just like Martin said, reach out to the other side and get it done. And so a lot of what you watch on C-SPAN, C-SPAN 1, C-SPAN 2, Senate and House, is the discussion at a debate level. But there's an awful lot more going on between in the committees and us talking with each other and floating bills and saying, will you get on this bill with me as a Republican, and then let's try this out and see if it moves a little bit. And so I wouldn't be discouraged in terms of what you see. And I think we all should kind of follow the and analyze and look, you know, the 80-20 rule. If you really sit down with your neighbor and your friends and talk things through, you're going to come up with agreement. And it doesn't mean that the 20% you disagree on, that you just you put it aside for a little bit to make progress on the 80. But the 20 is you're going to come back to after you move along in the progress. And so I just think it's being pragmatic. It's working with each other. And if I wasn't committed to do that, I'd get out of here. This is what I went to do, and I will continue to do it as long as I'm here. Thank you very much, and appreciate your involvement, and continue to stay involved.
Another question.
Yes. Okay. My name is Ellen Chavez from Las Cruces, and my question is, how realistic and feasible would it be to go back to paper ballots for elections?
Paper ballots.
Yeah, we have paper ballots.
We have paper ballots.
In New Mexico, but not nationwide.
Well, we have paper ballots in New Mexico, as you know, right?
Right. I work with an election.
We have the paper ballot, and you fill in the little deal. I just did one in Santa Fe. We had a vote up there on an issue, and you just shove it in. And so then they save all those if you had a recount, and you can go through it. But the computer does the counting.
Right, but
we don't have that nationwide, as Martin just pointed out.
I worked as an election observer here in New Mexico, and we have that. But it seems like there's no way to you were talking earlier about hacking, Russian hacking in the
Martin,
state. So,
well, the thing that we need to do in the area that you work in, which is the integrity of the and this is where we know people were in our election system in county clerks' kind of offices in the ability to get into there where the registrations were is make sure that's absolutely protected so you can't delete voters where they can't vote on election day, and then the voting when it takes place on election day with the machines and the ballots. And I think the safest thing we do is having the paper ballot, which is maintained, and then it's inserted through a machine and counted. And then, you know, if there's any issue, we're able to go back and look at that manually or evaluate whether the machine was manipulated or not. But I think it's going to be a big lift to force every election jurisdiction in the country to do it New Mexico's way. We all need to talk about, kind of back to the 80-20 rule, is let's talk about how we're secure in our voting, and let's just make sure that nobody can interfere with it, and it's going to be honest and straightforward and have integrity, and that we're going to have confidence in the outcome.
What about programs like cross-check?
Programs like what?
Cross-check.
Cross-check. I'm going to leave that one to Martin.
So is cross-check where people are removed from the ballot if they don't?
Okay. Cross-check is a program that they have. Let's say you have somebody whose name is Maria Elena Chavez.
Right.
And American style, we go by Maria and just drop the Elena, or Maria E.
Right.
So that's
so
that
people inadvertently get taken out of the rolls, or
because
advertently
person,
get taken out of
person,
the rolls.
One Maria Chavez voted, therefore all of them are going to be taken out, or every Maria E or Maria or whatever else.
Once again, this goes back to, and the way our system, voting system works in the country is that we really do address these at the state by state issue. And I've had these conversations with my friends from lots of other states. It matters who your Secretary of State is. It matters who your county clerk is. And it matters what your state legislature does, because some state legislatures have passed laws that have made it a whole lot harder for American citizens to vote. So we need to make sure that right here in our backyard, if you have a right to vote, if you are a legal voter, that you can actually do that. I think we've done a good job of making sure that we have paper ballots as well, so that there's a record. So if there's an argument, you can go back and fight about that. When I worked on the campaign side when I was much younger, there was a time when we had a state rep race where the gentleman that I was supporting won weeks later by, I think it was 3 votes. And because there were paper ballots and provisional ballots, you could go through ballot by ballot to that level of specificity. And then the final thing that we need to do, given where we are today, and we're trying to use the national infrastructure and our FBI and our intelligence agencies to help with this, is to make sure that our secretaries of state have secure databases that are not manipulatable from the outside. So a database that is safe, not connected to the internet, that can't be manipulated electronically from the outside, so that you have once again the gold standard to go back to make sure that every legal vote counts.
And
place for us to conclude to remind everyone that voting is the most important thing in each and every election. I want to thank all the staff and the volunteers that made this important discussion go smoothly. The Las Cruces Convention Center staff has been great in their support of this event, and we also appreciate our translators from the Lewis Luna Agency and WeInterpret.net, and to the KRWG staff, my colleagues, and our sister stations, KUNM, KANW, and KENW, for bringing the town hall meeting to the entire state. Finally, I want to thank Senator Heinrich and Senator Udall for giving us this great opportunity this evening, and they have some closing remarks now before we say goodnight, and we'll begin with Senator Heinrich.
The only thing I have left to say is to say thank you, because democracy is not a spectator sport, and you are participating. And the more you participate, the better this conversation will go. The better we'll be able to do our jobs, the more informed we'll be. And don't just do this tonight. Do it from here into the future. Be engaged. Know your local elected officials. I mean, here in Las Cruces, you look around the room and you see county commissioners and, you know, your state representatives, they show up at the local grocery store. So get to know them. And yeah, bend their ear. Give them a hard time when they do something you don't like, but also say pat them on the back when they do something you do like. Have that conversation. You know, our country grew out of that, and the kind of democracy we've been when we've been at our best is when that social conversation is ongoing. And respect the people that disagree with you. I have to work with folks all the time that I disagree with. All of us do. What we care about, what Senator Udall and what I care about, is making sure that the country that we hand over to our kids and our grandkids, that the state that we hand over, has a brighter future. And we can only do that if we work together. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bravo, Martin, and very well put. Let me just add there. When President Obama gave his farewell address, he said the biggest check on a presidency, this is someone, you know, he's all done 8 years and been there, had to deal with Congress, had to deal with foreign leaders, but he said the biggest check on a president is an engaged citizenry. And that's really what democracy is about. Democracy is about engaging. It's about caring. It's about putting pressure on your elected leaders. It's about weighing in. And it's about doing everything, the things that you care about, being passionate about it and sticking with it. And so I just applaud you tonight for being here, for being patient, for spending 2 hours with us and sharing your point of view, because believe me, it helps me do my job a lot better to hear from you, to hear the things that concern you. And please stop by our offices anytime. Our office in Las Cruces, it's probably the numbers in the phone book, but it's 575-526-5475, and my staff's here with staff cards, so you can get that from them. And we have a DC phone number too, but email us, call us, stay in touch. We love to hear from you, and it really makes a difference. Thank you for your participation today.
Thank you, Senator Udall, Senator Heinrich. Thanks to our audiences here in Las Cruces and around the state. As we've heard from our senators, your participation in tonight's Democratic Forum is critical. Keep it up. If you have further questions for the senators, submit them through their websites or by calling their offices.
Really,
thanks to our NMSU student volunteers. And you may come forward for a photo. I'm Fred Martino. Have a great week, everybody.
A lot better.